Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about more about this control flow integrity idea, going with some kind of actual implementation. Started out with kind of this research paper idea, which we saw we had these kind of two, arguably three different kind of ways of implementing. So we had kind of the hardware-assisted version that Intel and ARM have adopted, so that we actually see code for, and maybe sometimes it's turned on, where, you know, we're not going to bother protecting returns because we have either shadow stacks or stack canaries to do that, but we're going to protect sort of computed jumps, indirect jumps, by marking the valid targets for indirect jumps with a special instruction. Intel used the name NVR64 for the 64 version of this, and ARM calls it BTI for branch target indication. And the idea is that when a feature is on in these processors, those computed jump instructions check that when we have a jump that's looking something up in a table or something like that, it makes sure it goes to that instruction, and if it doesn't, it says false, basically. And so this gives us actually a lot of the advantages of control flow integrity in that it makes return-oriented programming, which remember was based on the idea that we return to something that wasn't intended to be run, or that we jump, or, you know, kind of variations of that where we like overwrote a vtable pointer to point to some code that was never really a function. It deals with that, but it's a lot less nice than what our original control flow integrity idea was, where we'd, you know, kind almost precisely identify what function could be wrong. But there's this kind of spectrum between how precisely we identify what the correct control paths are and enforce that at runtime, and how, you know, and how easy and efficient our implementation is. And we saw even kind of the original, that research paper version of control flow integrity was still making these compromises in that we only tracked where could this piece of code jump to without taking into account, well, how was that piece of code called? Right, so we had to have it work all the possible ways it could be called. We could imagine ways of kind of being more sophisticated than that, but obviously that's gonna have, you know, a lot more overhead and a lot more complexity as far as, you know, what is our compiler doing to set this up. We also talked about kind of the other kind of, I think, popular real implementation in this area of ARM's pointer authentication. So our pointer authentication, it isn't like control flow integrity because we aren't like figuring out at compile time what should run. But we're achieving many of the same goals in that rather than just having any old function pointer in a vtable or global offset table or all sorts of other places, we make sure that we only allow specific pointers. In this case, though, the way we identify the specific pointer is that we don't store just the pointer, we store the pointer with a message authentication code. And the hope is that that code is only produced by kind of trustable code, and that sort of the attacker won't have a way of producing a pointer to something they want with a valid message authentication code, because they don't have a way of running that code and they need to do that to do the attack in the first place, we hope. And we saw that this technique was kind of flexible, and maybe flexible in a way that kind of our NVR64 solution wasn't, in that we could relatively easily kind of pack extra information into the authentication code to like make sure that not only was this pointer authenticated, but it was authenticated that it was a pointer used to store it in this part of the stack, right? And that pointer can't be reused elsewhere, or a pointer used in for a method with this name rather than just any old method pointer. questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, so my main topic for today and Friday, it's going to be web stuff. I have mixed opinions on what I have prepared. I'm navigating two things. So one is I probably should try, there's probably some way of having more practical exercises in these slides that I didn't do because I was worried about other things. The other is I know we have some topics that were covered in 3710, pretty much always, and I'm trying to navigate having enough review to make sure we're all on the same page versus like boring everyone. So we have kind of what we're going to talk about is like our web browser is, you know, talks to multiple websites, and this is why this is the biggest reason why we have special web security problems. I'm going to kind of focus on the problems that come up because our web browser needs to somehow talk to multiple websites, and we want to keep the website separate, but only kind of, right? Websites actually do talk to each other, they link to each other, and often they do much more than link to each other, right? We have login with Google or Facebook or whatever. You know, that functionality is something we want to work, which definitely involves a lot of talking to each other mediated by the web browser. And the web browser, like historically, just display kind of static web pages, but really websites these days are kind of programs, which both kind of run on the browser and also store data on the browser. So I hope this is mostly review stuff. And we're going to talk about sort of HTTP requests and responses. So I want to just refresh what those are. So when we have a URL like this, that goes to some server.com, we're going to connect to that server. We're going to send a request with part of the URL. And the host name supplied in there. We aren't going to include this anchor stuff. And we also have a bunch of key value pairs. We're going to talk about some ones of them that are especially relevant to security later. And when we send that, we send that with a method. And kind of importantly for us, like, there is supposed to be a different method for doing modifications on the web server than not. And if you don't obey this rule, some of the security mechanisms that web browsers are doing for you won't happen. And when we get a response, it has a status code and other of what are these are called headers, and then the actual content, commonly a web page, but it's all sorts of our other documents. So hopefully this is all review for people. Okay. And an important thing that's going to come up when we think about attacking websites is how logins are actually implemented. And this is like why we have concerns about things like cross-site scripting. And the most common mechanism, though not the only mechanism, is to use cookies. And cookies are information for the client to send on future requests to the server. And basically, one of those key value pairs in the HTTP response says, here's a cookie to send later. And then the client sends that back with almost every HTTP request to that server in the future. And also, the website program can read or set a cookie too. So, seen this before. And the cookie data typically contains something that we call a session ID. And I have problems with porting these slides. That's usually tied to a database on the server. This is not relevant because I have missing some context for that. And it's supposed to be kept secret by the login user. It's really that effectively this is what makes you log in or not. And the cookie also has information about where to send it. So it can have a domain that it restricts to, and kind of the web, kind of privileges, things that are related by the server name. And it has an expires field, and there's a whole bunch of security things. Some of these we'll talk about. Yeah?
Do you think about like a service like Cloudflare, where if you have like your main website, if you log in and it gives you a cookie, and then you navigate to like a subdomain, like you went to like pages.cloudflare.net, like one of those like very sub-websites, would you still send that cookie?
Question, would we still send that cookie? So this depends on the domain setting in the cookie versus where we got it. So we should only be able to set the domain to something that is encompasses where the cookie came from. But for example, www.facebook.com can hypothetically set a cookie that only works for www.facebook or that works for all of facebook.com. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So another thing that comes up is that when we're sending information to websites, there's kind of two ways of doing this. I'm going to show the old traditional way of HTML forms. And there's also scripts that like make their own format. But showing how HTML form works kind of is useful for informing us about that. So here I have some fields with a form, and oh, I added a hidden field. This is a broken example. Okay. That I have something I need to fix. And basically, we got this input queue. If I type what I search for, it gets encoded in a URL for a form that goes to a GET request that's supposed to not modify things on the server. And we can also have forms that go to a put request that is supposed to modify things on the server. And note that we can have hidden fields. And maybe, I don't know, if it, one of the most common kind of naive web developer mistakes is not realizing that this is all controlled by the client. So this hypothetical form here, I can just change this in locally and submit to it and use it to spam people. It's just a real common vulnerability kind of in the early days of the internet. Another thing worth noting about these forms is that I specified the action here, and that didn't have to be my own website. But I can have forms that go to some other website that is perfectly fine. And this gives us kind of our also hopefully review. Who remembers CSRF? Cross-site request forgery. Who doesn't remember cross-site request forgery? Okay. So this gives us cross-site request forgery. So I'll give an example of this idea, right? We can make a form that submits to anywhere, right? Any destination URL. And as an actual example of like probably the most disturbing CSRF flaw I have heard of, Gmail in 2007 used something like a form submission. Probably was done via JavaScript, but you could simulate it with a form to like set up a mail forwarding filter. So what we have here is at the time of 2007, this is just a form which, if you click the submit button for the form, would create a filter on the currently logged in Gmail user that forwards all emails to evil@evil.com. And you might say, well, okay. And I mentioned, you may say, okay, so we have to get someone to click the button. No, we don't. So as an attacker, I can put this on my website, and if someone's logged into Gmail, I can just conveniently have my form submit that for them, my JavaScript code submit that for them. No user interaction required. And this is cross-site request forgery because kind of what the designers of the Gmail form at this time were assuming was that, well, of course, no one would, anyone submitting this form would be coming from our website, and they didn't check that that was actually true. So questions about this? Yes?
What was the form for?
This is for, so in Gmail, you can set up an email filter, and you can say, for the emails that match this filter, I want to forward them to another email. So this is specifying the parameters. So this is doing the equivalent of that email filter. Rather than having that all typed in or with checkboxes, we've just made hard-coded hidden inputs, but it's just equivalent to what the checkboxes and things you type in would be. And setting to, say, forward to evil at evil.com. Other questions? Yeah.
So like this, it's that like Gmail has a legitimate form, and then I can go myself make an other identity form that points to the same place, like send the local press to the same place. But how does it get the user's cookies from a valid?
So the question is, if I copied Gmail's form, how does it get the user's cookies? So a rule for how cookies worked is that the client sends back the cookie with almost every HTTP request. And if someone who's logged into Gmail is visiting your website and their browser submits the form, that's an HTTP request made by the browser. It's going to include the cookies. There's not an exception here for only submit it if the user clicked a button or something like that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
But I thought that the cookies are limited to particular domains. So if you're not on
question, a- you thought the cookies were limited to particular domains? Yes, and it's the domain that we're sending the request to. And the request here is going to Google. It has to go to Google. It can't set the filter otherwise. Yeah, so yeah, it's about what server am I connecting to, not about why did I do that. Other questions? So this idea is known as cross-site request forgery. We're making a request from another site that site anticipated it wouldn't come from there. And this is because there's no restriction that any web page can make requests to other web pages, and this is kind of an extension of the linking idea. And this kind of non-intuitively applies, even though I've told you that these post requests are meant to be separate out things that modify stuff versus the get ones. Right, so get ones make sense, right? That's a link. Like just getting a website, of course you can do that from another website, you can go to a different one, but you can actually make requests that modify things. And kind of the problem here is that there's this thing that's not intuitive for authors of web applications, that the request including a cookie doesn't mean the user authorized it. That we need some other way to do it. And we actually don't want to do kind of the proposal you have of, oh, when I'm going from one site to another, I shouldn't send cookies, because you want it to be the case for that when you go from website A to website B, if you're logging to website B, you still look like you're logging to website B. So you do want to send the cookies. And it's not the case that the browser doesn't kind of have some protections against sort of the access from one website to another. Like, for example, we can't read the response, but we don't care. Right, if we set up the email filter, we're good in this case. So how can we do this? How can we defend against this? So kind of the obvious idea that would come up is that there's this header refer, which you may notice is misspelled, and that is deliberate because that is how it is spelled in the standard. That is actually what is sent. And this is where the browser sends, where did the request come from? The problem is this isn't always sent. There's some context where the browser will not send this. So the real solution is we add a secret token to the form, and that token needs to not be guessable, which means you need to have it like change for every user at the least. And the idea of that token is that now, you know, when I as the attacker make this form, I can't fill in that token, which needs to be one of these inputs. Another part of class of defense is that so there's some special types of requests that browsers only allow if it comes from a website on the same, what they call origin, basically from the same website. So you could require it be one of those special types of requests. And kind of the other example, other thing to mention about this is that like CSRF is something you have to worry about a lot of cases. One of the more subtle cases is doing this for a login form. That you can have some user log in as you without them intending to. And, you know, therefore like write documents in your document folder and not theirs. And the defense against this is that you need that token even on like the login form. So that's cross-site request forgery in my brief foray. So that's apparently not less review than I hoped. Some people are just forgotten. Okay, so next we're gonna talk about cross-site scripting. And I think the idea is that, right, so a website, in this case, I have some PHP code here where we said, oh, you know, I want you to, you know, I have this login form, and the idea is the login form, well, after you log in, we have to send you to the rights page that required the login, so we'll have this redirect to parameter, and, you know, we'll send you to foo, and we'll just put that as a hidden form parameter so when you actually log you in, we can then send you to the right page. And the problem with this is that I can put some interesting places to redirect to that have our classic command injection problem that when I substitute this in here, I end up having this script tag. And here I'm showing an example of what sort of thing an attacker would do to take advantage of this. So in this case, I told you the cookie like tells us that we're, you know, how to log in. We can just send that. In this case, I'm sending it to evil.com by loading an image from evil.com that I never display, which has the cookie in its file name. Questions? This cross-site scripting example. Does this look familiar? Not familiar? Okay. And this I notice I'm calling reflected cross-site scripting. And the idea here is that we just get someone to go to this website, and even if they don't interact, you know, their browser is going to send that cookie to evil.com. The other I guess I should mention, we can get them to go to the website, and we can do this kind of silently in another website by embedding, you know, as a iframe as a way of embedding a website in another website. We can do that We can also, make this use some CSS to, or I probably should do, we can make this iframe really hard to see. And make it really subtle that that's happening. The other kind of form of cross-site scripting that comes up is what we'll call stored cross-site scripting, where like I have a comment form here, and I just put in a comment that has something that will turn into scripts, which is probably not intended. And so that's what we're, so we end up getting, kind of this case where it's like week six. So let's talk a bit about kind of two sides, like detecting cross-site scripting and kind of some mitigations. And by mitigations, I mean the same kind of thing as stack canaries. These are things that are not going to completely solve the problem, but in practice are going to make cross-site scripting a lot harder to exploit. So let's start with detection. So one idea for cross-site scripting detection, some of this we alluded to earlier when I talked about like taint tracking, this sort of idea that when we run a program, we can kind of try to look at where does input end up in the output. We kind of saw something like this with how the symbolic execution stuff work, and we can apply this idea to try to do cross-site scripting. And as a concrete example, I'm not going to go through the details because of this, because, well, I didn't read the paper that carefully, and also it's using stuff that really requires you to remember DMT2 stuff. But this paper from 2008 in ICSI, a software engineering conference, basically what they did is they said, they tried to look over a program and did something kind of like our symbolic execution, where we tried to like get a formula for a value. But instead of getting a formula, they went to get the string equivalent of that. And they used context-free grammars, which if you've taken DMT2, I think you've seen, as the way, their way of trying to summarize what the program did with its input and turning it into its output. And then they basically just tried to solve that to figure out, could there be a script tag as a result of what's in, from the input? And their example in the paper is that like they took some PHP code and kind of normalized it and converted that to this sort of pseudo context-free grammar. And then they basically tried to solve, well, given that we know that request module here comes from user input, can we modify request module to make there be a script tag or something else that runs scripts? And as I'm glossing over a bunch of the details here, partly because it's a bunch of DMT2 and also like compiler stuff that we didn't expect. Don't have time to cover because I didn't read the paper super carefully, but this gives an idea of the sort of things people have been thinking about for like static detection. We can also imagine dynamic way. But probably the more popular technique for trying to detect cross-site scripting, and maybe you did this in 3710, is just try input that's likely to run code. Is this something you did in 3710? Okay, yeah. And kind of the challenge with this is that context matters, right? The code I want to put in, so here, if I have unfiltered or poorly filtered user input in all these places, these are all places I could run scripts, but how I do that is going to be different in each of these locations. Right, so like an input you might have tried is like, script something, script, and that, in fact, does not work in any of these places, even though it worked in some other places. and we need to like kind of customize or input to the exact situation that we have. So for example, what should my attack look like to go here? How would I prove that that's a cross-site scripting vulnerability? Yeah.
Is there a way that you can execute code in CSS?
Is there a way you can execute code in CSS?
Or would you have to close
the side pad? Not in modern browsers. There are certainly bad things you can do in CSS. Okay. I have an example talking about that later. But the simplest way, yes, is to get out of the styles hand. So what would that look like? So you want to end the style tag, how does that look?
So slash style, and then put your script doing whatever you're going to do again, and then reopen a different style tag so that it doesn't crack.
And then open a new style tag, yeah. So that would be probably a way of doing that. If you wanted to be cleaner, we could end this font here and make the style not be so bad, but not necessary. So, yeah, that's kind of the challenge. And like, for example, here, what we want to do, the easiest thing to do is not to have any extra script tags at all, but we want to do like, have a end quote, you know, something like this would probably be the easiest way. And where I got inspired for this example is like, let's find recent papers on this. So this is a 2024 paper on, we want to synthesize things we can test programs with that work a lot of the time. And they call it polyglot because it's something that works in a lot of different contexts. And kind of the sort of things we're talking about coming up with are you just try to merge all the sorts of ways of fitting in a context, and you have a few of these. And probably the weird capitalization is either just a randomness factor or that some people stupidly look for JavaScript in what you're putting in and filter that out without thinking about that it's not case sensitive. You might say, why is JavaScript colon here? This is because this is JavaScript code. This runs JavaScript. And that sort of thing is why people mess this up, is because who would know that you can run JavaScript and source in an image tag, but you absolutely can. So, do I not have the slides for that? Oh, interesting. So how do we sort of mitigate cross-site scripting? So one thing is kind of the big best is to host dangerous stuff on another domain. This is kind of the most paranoid approach, but this is commonly something you'll see for major websites that if you look at like stuff you upload will be served from a completely different domain name. And this is partly to make it so if there's a cross-site scripting attack where we can load like the file you uploaded as a web page and it has JavaScript in it, that doesn't do anything useful because it's from a different site, even if it's hosted on the same web server. The other thing is, you know, the classic thing that you probably recommended in 37.10 is you filter or escape your inputs. This is just a thing where you can get things wrong, right? So I mentioned the example of the image URL, like, surprise. Your image source JavaScript is bad. And I'd say, okay, well, we'll just allow, like, the word script. Here we go. My URL is x double quote on error equals, you know, that's going to run that JavaScript code to handle the error of not loading the x image. But, you know, you can do filtering, right? You just need to be kind of careful about it. Like, the technique I recommend is you think from things you know are okay, not things you know are bad. That's the biggest mistake people make. So then we're going to get into solutions, which these I would say are mitigations, right? These are not solving the problem. These are making it less likely that it's exploitable, or at least maybe me helping you know. So one thing that comes up that is not something I actually recommend, but is popular in industry, so I should talk about it, is web application firewalls. And kind of the idea here is that we could set up our web servers to have something before the web application that looks for people doing things, you know, like this. So as an example, they'll have these rules, and this is saying if the cookies or the file name or the arguments match this pattern here, then do something about it. Now, the reason why I say I don't like this is because I think it, just like with antivirus scanners, it's likely a clever attacker can evade some of these rules, and just like with antivirus scanners, we're likely to have false positives. Yeah.
What advantages would like a web application firewall offer over just escaping text?
How do you do it? What advantage would be? This would be something you usually do in addition.
Okay.
Right. The idea is that you assume the web application you deployed is probably might have some bugs, and you'd like to know if it has some bugs, and also you'd like to be informed if someone is trying to do cross-site scripting attacks on your website. You'd like to have records of that. And that's kind of the problem the web application firewall is solving. It's not a primary line of defense. This is a mitigation. It's making the problem hopefully less bad. And it's not really solving the problem. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And we'll talk about these two other ones, HTTP-only cookies and content security policy. So HTTP-only cookies. So a setting we can add on cookies is something labeled HTTP-only. And you might say, oh, that means it doesn't work in HTTPS. Fortunately not. That means it doesn't work in JavaScript. So this is a way of marking cookies to say, this cookie should never be made available to scripts. The web browser will still keep it. It will still send it when it usually would. And this eliminates kind of one of the more obvious ways of actually exploiting cross-site scripting, which is that you want to take a user that's logged in and become logged in like them. Copying their cookie is the easiest way of doing that. This makes it so you can't copy their cookie. It doesn't really solve the cross-site scripting problem because scripts on a web page can still access stuff on that domain. So for example, one thing we can do is rather than sending the cookie value, we can just retrieve stuff on the web page and send it. And you might say, okay, well that's only reading stuff, right? We can't like do what we normally do when we're logged in and like change things. Well, we can do that too. So as an example, I can make a frame to embed the same website, and if I'm on the same, if I'm embedding a website from the same domain, I'm allowed to access things inside that frame, including like submitting and filling in forms. So even though we don't actually get direct access to the user cookies, you know, we can, as an attacker, kind of automate the user's browsers to do everything we want while they're logged in, using the ability to run scripts on the domain. Now, this is probably still worth doing. This is a lot more work for the attacker to construct this for whatever they want to do, and also, when they're done, the attacker doesn't get access to login credentials indefinitely unless they manipulate the forms to let them like change the password or something. Which is probably hard because usually you enter the previous password or do like some verification via email. Right. So this like does seriously, you know, does still limit things, but it doesn't really solve the problem, but it makes it less bad. And it's also super easy to implement. It's just really easy to just add this flag to your cookies that you know you don't need in scripts. So questions about HTTP only? So another option is content security policy. So this is a header that's sent in the response by the web server. And it tells browsers, hey, when you're loading things from this website, here's where I want you to get other things from. And we can say, for example, that only load things from the same host and also, or that are embedded in the web page. So that means that our trick of loading an image from evil.com, the web browser will just say, the content security policy says that that's not allowed. I'm not going to do that. And that makes it just very hard to exfiltrate the information from our cross-site scripting vulnerability. We can also use this to kind of specify where scripts come from. So we can say, for example, this web page shouldn't load any scripts from anywhere. Just don't run scripts on this web page. Don't load like videos on this webpage. Don't load style sheets on this webpage. And so this, you know, if we can have a strict enough policy, can make cross-site scripting, you know, based very hard to actually usefully exploit. And we'll actually do better than this. And we'll see in a sec. And so we asked about, why do we care about style sheets? So one reason we care about style sheets is that this is a way of exfiltrating information from a website. So one thing, let's say we have some user input before some web page content. We can just say, oh, here's the start of a style sheet reference. And by the way, and have the rest of the URL of the style sheet be whatever was normally in the website. So if we happen to have, and so like if we have a case where we have user input something and username, right, this idea would let us here have our link href equals, and it would include be like evil.com/, and it would include the username potentially. So that's one reason we want to prevent that, want to restrict style sheets. So even without doing anything interesting in the style sheet, we can sometimes use this to get information around our cross-site scripting injection. And also, even if the injection like correctly prevents scripts, we can do it. The other thing is that we can just restyle things in interesting ways. So if we have a pre-filled in form, we can just say, oh, well, if the pre-filled in value starts with Virginia, load this background image, please. And we can check, is that background image ever loaded on our evil.com logs? Or we can just very, very maliciously restyle things to look, to make the user do different things. So here I just say, you know, we'll just say, make our form say, please verify that you are human before it. We'll just get rid of the cancel button. We'll get rid of the text and the delete button and add this text that says, I am human, in nice readable font. And, you know, that's a reason we probably shouldn't allow malicious style sheets, even though more work to pull off. The CSS is just very flexible, even though we usually don't do this sort of thing with it. So other things with content security policy. Mentioned the example, we can have sign of here. So something that's notable about how content security policy works, when I specify where scripts can come from, if I don't specify they can be inline in the web page, it disallows inline scripts. So this content security policy rule says that any scripts on the web page have to be loaded from some other file, because we didn't specify they were allowed in the web page. Also, there's usually, you know, if we want to explicitly allow nothing to start and then whitelist things, which is what you should do, but it's often very tricky, we can do that. Now, you might say, so disallowing all scripts in the web page, this is actually really great for avoiding cross-site scripting bugs, right? It makes it really, really hard to exploit cross-site scripting bugs if the only way you can have scripts is if they're loaded via another tag. Not impossible. We can still have an injection of a script source equals evil.com. But it gets rid of a lot of kind of the more subtle cases. And if we only also allow them to come from our current web page, makes it pretty. But it's really inconvenient not to have inline scripts. So content security policy has the solution for that of nonces. That we can specify this nonce in the content security policy, and we can have scripts in the web page, but they have to be marked with this nonce, or the browser won't load. And as an attacker, it's very hard for you to make a new script tag with the correct nonce, because presumably the nonce should be changed every time. The other notable thing about content security policy is that they thought about one of the issues with this sort of thing is, from an incentive point of view, the only thing adding a content security policy can do to your web page in normal operation is break it. Right? Obviously, it protects against attacks, but as far as when you're not being attacked, the normal user experience, it can only break things. So as kind of a way to help deal with this, there's also a second version of the content security policy header called content security policy report only, where rather than prohibiting something, when the browser detects something would have been disallowed, it just sends a message to your server saying, hey, this didn't match any of the rules. And this serves as both a way, before you set a binding policy, you can just have this on your website for like a week and see, did I miss anything? Or if you can't chance breaking your website, you can set this policy and monitor that, you know, to act on, you know, so you still have some of the benefits of this kind of whitelisting idea, but don't break your website proactively to do it if you missed a case, as might be common if you, like, you're integrating a whole bunch of third-party websites, or if you look at, like, realistic content security policies. Oh, I think to end up talking about kind of the reality of this, let's pull up, I know why I'm not logged into Teams. My where is my Yeah, pull up here. There's teams.microsoft.com's content security policy. You can see why that might be error prone.
Well, I knew it would be error prone if it said Teams.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the like local group for developers, I guess, for them? Like they have a bunch of like the HTTPS, HTTP local
host for your. I'm guessing the local host stuff is for the Teams desktop client, but I'm not sure, or for development. Or an error. Yeah. So that's example. So we'll talk a little more about that.